I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast brought to you today by the folks at Mimecast. I'm joined on a call now with Brian Pinnock, Director of Sales Engineering in the Middle East and Africa at Mimecast. Brian, welcome to the podcast. How are you guys holding up through the lockdown?
Thanks, Duncan. Quite well, actually. I think we one of the more fortunate companies that we can largely work from home. And I think quite early on globally, we made a move to have as many people as possible getting out of the office and working from home. And then obviously when the lockdown happened, everybody was forced to do that. But by design, the company is actually quite well designed, which we're starting to see a number of companies countrywide who are actually not that well designed in terms of working from home, certainly at a volume level that we're seeing now. And that's one of the challenges that our clients are seeing.
Yeah, but you guys are pretty well suited being a tech company to work remotely. And I'm sure many of you guys were working remotely before any of this crisis started anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And being a security company, we obviously have the remote security side sort of well in hand. So it can be a little bit, you know, it can make things a bit challenging when, you know, because security is always kind of balanced out against usability. And we tend to err on the side of security as opposed to usability. Mm-hmm. But we've also got a lot of people who are on the road. You know, my team covers, you know, the ambit of the whole of South Africa, Africa and the Middle East. So the guys are traveling to all kinds of strange places, working out of hotels and various other things. So we really do have to sort of lock down our security and have proper endpoint protection and visibility, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that in some detail during this podcast. But for those who are new to Mimecast or perhaps just heard the company's name and don't have a clear idea of what it is you guys do, maybe just give us a very quick refresher.
Okay, interesting one, because I always ask people who are interviewing for jobs at Mimecast how they would describe Mimecast at a braai or something. So I think in short, Mimecast is a cybersecurity company. It has South African roots. So the two founders of Mimecast are actually two South Africans, Peter Bauer and Neil Murray. They started the company in London. And we now actually operate in multiple geographic jurisdictions. So North America, Europe, the UK, Africa, Middle East, Australia. So very, very broad coverage. And the focus of the company started on email security, but we've now moved into other aspects of security like web security as well. So really, you know, things like email archiving, email security, and protecting people when they go out onto the internet.
Mm-hmm. And you've been with the company about 3 years or so now. You previously were with Dimension Data and Internet Solutions, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right. Actually, I was had a very long tenure at Dimension Data and IS, about sort of 8 years in both separately. And then got a call from Brandon Becker, who is now heading up our Europe, Middle East, Africa operations. At the time, he was heading up the South African operation. He asked me if I wanted to move across. And it was quite a big jump, but it was quite nice to be working for a smaller organization. I mean, we're quite large for a cybersecurity firm. We've got well over 100 staff in South Africa, which is quite big for a vendor. Mm. But in terms of, you know, compared to, say, the size of a Dimension Data or Internet Solutions, you know, much, much smaller. You know, you get to know absolutely everybody in the company. And it's nice to play a sort of a much more impactful role, you know, in the sort of senior management team here.
Yeah. Good. Well, we're gonna chat about cybersecurity in the context of what's happening in the world today. We have millions of people working from home at the moment, and I'm sure this has introduced all sorts of headaches for IT administrators. Are we seeing cyber criminals adjusting their attack vectors to take advantage of the situation?
So absolutely, yes. What we had is, I think the cyber criminals were as surprised by the sort of speed of the crisis as we were. So what's happened is, as IT has had to adapt rapidly to all this remote working and virtual collaboration and, you know, protecting vulnerable users who sort of may not be as well set up as somebody who's, you know, behind a traditional firewall, I think the attackers were sort of geared to their normal kind of attack process. They responded quite quickly. And we saw, and we can go into some of the details of the stats, but just to give you one example, just since January, we've seen over 115,000 new coronavirus domains. So as early as kind of late February, we're seeing over 1,000 a month being registered, you know, all linked to something to do with COVID-19, you know, various sort of combinations of that. So yeah, these guys picked up on it quite quickly. And you know, as if I was in that game as a threat actor, this is kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity to literally leverage all of the factors that come into play when you're involved in any form of sort of cyber fraud or cyber attack. You know, you've got this unsettled environment. You've got people who are very emotionally, you know, sort of fraught over all kinds of issues, you know, working from home, challenges. I mean, I heard a good comment the other day saying, we're not actually working from home. We're in a crisis at home trying to get work done. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is literally what's happening all over the place. So, yeah, it's. I think users are a lot more susceptible at the moment, and the attackers have pivoted a bit more quickly than IT departments have. You know, everybody's been scrambling. As I said, the volume has actually been the biggest challenge. A lot of companies have had work from home. I mean, even at Mimecast, we've all been working remotely for a long time, but it's very different when you can only work remotely. You know, you suddenly yes. find things you could pop into the office and pick something up, and that now you can't do that. You've literally just got to work with what you have at the moment.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. And I think particularly for organizations that are not geared to this sort of thing, we were saying it's a lot easier. I mean, it's certainly a lot easier in the media industry where I play, and in the IT space where people are used to the tools, they understand the technology and what it's capable of doing for them. But I imagine in organizations where which aren't in these fields, it's a much more difficult proposition.
Yeah, and we've actually seen quite a broad range. So we've seen companies who kind of more aligned with the way Mimecast works, who've kind of very smoothly adapted to working from home. They've had to tighten up a few aspects. You know, and I'll give you one example, just trying to get additional threat intelligence around these new coronavirus-related URLs and domains that have been created. You know, sort of just tightening up the security a bit. But overall, their endpoint protection was strong. Their VPN services could handle the demand and all of those sorts of things. And they actually had good visibility on people who are remote working. And then on the sort of extreme end of this, you know, that's on the one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, you had companies who mostly expected people to work from the office and didn't even have necessarily the equipment for all their end users to be working from home. And that's, apart from a whole bunch of issues, like, for example, end users may not have the appropriate data set up. So, you know, might be okay to do a bit of email from home until you sort of hop in the car and drive into the office, but it's a completely different story if you're working off 3G or LTE services and having to do, you know, an 8-hour day doing Zoom calls or WebEx calls or whatever the case may be. So, and then again, the security side, one of the big issues we've seen, and, you know, as most companies have done, we've sort of stepped in to try and assist, is we found a lot of companies who were pretty good on the VPN side of things, but didn't have other forms of endpoint protection. So one of the first things users do when they have a poor quality video call is they start turning off services that might be impacting the, you know, the quality of the video. And one of those is your VPN. And if that's the only form of protection that you've got, suddenly your end users is vulnerable. So what we've done is actually offered a 90-day service to anyone who wants to use that service. We started with our existing client base, but we've actually opened that up. Anyone who wants to use our web security service can actually go to Mimecast and sign up for that. And we're going to offer that free with no strings attached during the time of the crisis.
Yeah. Is a VPN kind of a prerequisite for companies that are allowing their employees to work from home, or are there other security measures that you can put in place that perhaps obviate to some extent the need for a VPN?
So a VPN is kind of part of things. What a VPN mostly does is it allows, it encrypts the data stream from the end user's device to the head office, and it allows you to kind of tunnel from your home through to your head office and then break out to the internet from there. But a VPN is only one piece of the puzzle. What the VPN also does is it puts you behind the company firewall. So anything that you do on the internet, then your outbound traffic will go through the VPN and then you'll break out of your company firewall. So it's doing two things. It's generally the VPN is not doing the firewalling, although in some cases that is the case, but it's allowing the user to go through the firewall. What we find is the biggest issue right now is that threat actors have started sort of relatively unsophisticated campaigns, but the biggest focus right now has been on credential harvesting. So VPN doesn't really do much to stop credential harvesting. And what I mean by that is we've seen sites, I'll give you an example. There were some fake Netflix sites that were coming up saying free Netflix, or, you know, get Netflix, you know, well, however it worked, you know, that there's various lures to get you in. And essentially what they were doing is hoping you'd put in your corporate information and password. And as most hackers know, you kind of, a lot of people reuse their password, or at least reuse a kind of a root password with some very unsophisticated kind of slight additions like 123 or 456 on the end. So that's the challenge with a VPN. Back to your question around what other pieces you need, you absolutely need some form of endpoint protection. So what most people would refer to as antivirus, but obviously it's got a lot more sophisticated in the last sort of 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And then web security. You know, if the VPN is off for whatever reason, you're not going through a firewall, or even if you are going through the VPN, the real trick is to ensure that people are protected from going to bad sites. There's a huge number of bad sites out there. It's changing all the time. And people are getting lured in. We're also seeing home devices getting hacked. So I think it was Linksys routers. I could be mistaken about that. And, you know, I certainly don't want to sort of pick on any one particular brand, because sure, every brand is exposed. But a number of these sort of home internet routers have been attacked. And what they do is they intercept DNS calls. So you might type in google.com and it'll actually take you to a malicious site that's a lookalike, and then start trying to download malware to your machine. So VPN or not, if your endpoint, if your home router has been attacked in some way, or you've got some sort of home automation type system, those things are all at sort of risk, depending on how much security or lack, of security you have at home.
So during this lockdown period, during this COVID-19 crisis, where are the exploits coming from mostly? Are they email attack vectors predominantly?
So we saw a massive increase in what we kind of refer to as opportunistic attacks. So this massive spike in spoofed websites, and then using email as the vector to get people to go to those websites. But not only email, we see that happening in social media, WhatsApp, all kinds of things. So what started happening was with these sort of spoofed websites and the emails that went with them, is it kind of followed a bit of a pattern. So it started out initially, we saw these impersonation themes related to kind of doctors in Wuhan, China, offering details on the symptoms. And, you know, then as the kind of story around the pandemic started to move, so did these attacks. They then shifted to kind of emulating these government responses to the virus, saying that there was going to be lockdowns in Italy and certain states in the US and other countries started, suggesting there may be lockdowns or certainly sort of constraints on movement and social distancing, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the attackers shifted their story to kind of emulate what was going on in the media. Then we started having business responses. So different businesses saying they do certain things. Airlines, for example, offering flight refunds. We saw a lot of fake flight refund stories coming through. Quite sophisticated looking emails, very compelling, compelling emails, looking very sort of slick and legitimate. And then sort of as the kind of lockdown and all of that started to bite, we started to see the classic hacker attack, starting to monetize anxiety, really. So, I mean, at a very simplistic level, what hackers do is they use social engineering, and they kind of focus either on fear or greed. Right now it's fear, and the two sort of big fears is sort of health anxiety and financial anxiety. So we're starting to see various refunds and loans and all of those sorts of things being spoofed, as well as anxiety around, sort of pharmaceuticals. Often lots of fake cures and all of those. There's just been this massive, massive spike.
So you get one of these phishing emails or some sort of email that is luring you to click on a link, and you're then taken to a malicious website. What are the cyber criminals typically trying to do through those malicious websites? What code is there? What information are they trying to extract? What are they trying to do to the end user?
So they typically try and do a number of things, and usually not all at once. So the biggest one we're seeing right now is credential harvesting. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you, as I mentioned before, you reuse your credentials, and they know that. So they're trying to match known credential leaks that are out there on the dark web with the kind of information that you're putting in there, and they'll try and reuse that. And we see that all the time, particularly on Office 365 accounts, for example, where cyber criminals will try and attack Office 365, Gmail, basically any kind of email type account to try and get in there, because that's a great way to kind of take things further. The other thing they try and do is download, either directly download a piece of malware or download what's called a dropper, which is kind of a two-stage sort of attack. Mm-hmm. But in essence, it amounts to the same thing. They're trying to get some form of malware onto your machine. And once the malware is on your machine, it can then take many forms. You know, it could either just be a keylogger and have, you know, looking at things like your banking logon. Mm-hmm. It could be something that's it could be ransomware oriented. And you know, we saw a big spike. In fact, quite interestingly, most of these things followed a fairly similar pattern globally. Obviously, a big target in Europe and the US, but Australia, South Africa saw, you know, a commensurate rise. But then South Africa saw something quite interesting, which was a piece of malware written specifically for Android phones and targeted primarily at South Africa. We saw half a million emails in late March and I think early April as well. So over a billion emails sent to South African organizations with this particular piece of Android malware.
1 billion.
That's correct, yeah. So we there's a lot of email that gets stopped. So it was 500 million emails with this particular ransomware inside there.
Good grief.
Just with this one particular attack.
Good grief. And most of those would have been picked up by spam filters and blocked before they even get received by the end user.
So generally not. What's particularly for a piece of malware. So if something's not a so if depends on how the email is formulated. So the way things work is spam is typically only blocked when the email exhibits characteristics that are spammy, to kind of put into to simple terms. But a lot of email that has malicious content inside will then get through to the next layer of security, which is what we, you know, which would be something like looking for known viruses. Mm-hmm. And typically what we do and some other good cyber hygiene solutions do is email hygiene solutions is they'll then have multiple antivirus engines to look for these known viruses. But if it then gets through to the next level, which is where we were picking it up, is it then actually gets through to a sandbox. Mm-hmm. And a sandbox is essentially an emulated environment that sort of pretends to be the end device, either the mobile phone or the laptop desktop type environment. And that's where we were starting to pick up these this new Android malware. So this new Android malware would not have initially, at any rate, we obviously do a lot of threat sharing globally. So towards the later stages, once it had already been detected by us, we share that with a number of other industry players. They would then have picked that up. But early on, unless you had a sandbox somewhere in your kind of threat stack, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have picked that up at all. So, you know, a normal spam filter wouldn't have picked that up at all.
And what was this malware doing?
It was essentially just ransomware. When I say just ransomware, it's still a problem because what it would do is completely lock down your phone and turn it into a brick until you paid the ransom. I haven't actually dug down into the details of whether or not it was genuine ransomware or whether it was actually just something that locked down the device and there was actually no way of decrypting, because you get two kind of types of ransomware as well. Mm-hmm. One is actual ransomware where you pay a ransom, and the other one is actually just a locker which can never be unlocked.
Yeah. What are some of the trends around ransomware? I know there were some very high-profile ransomware attacks in South Africa in the past year. I think one involving the City Power, if I remember correctly, or the city of Joburg. Are we seeing an escalation of these sort of attacks, and how are organizations mitigating them?
So we are seeing an escalation in ransomware attacks. In fact, quite interestingly, ransomware kind of evolved through, and this is a kind of pattern you'll see a lot with cybercrime, is they tend to, the best way to think about it is as a business with a return on investment. So what they'll do is do as little as possible for as much gain as possible. So they're always working on that equation. So at one point in time, ransomware actually started declining because it was actually more cost effective and created more value to actually do crypto mining. So it was actually, if you wanted to get a piece of malware onto someone's machine, crypto mining was easier to get onto someone's machine, typically sat in a browser, which is a much easier target to get to. And so ransomware started to decline, and we started seeing news reports from various quarters, Microsoft being one of them, saying, you know, there's a decline in ransomware, you don't have to worry about ransomware too much anymore. That was about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then what started happening is we started picking up ransomware. As I mentioned to you before, what you have is a security stack where you've got things like spam, a normal known malware, and then finally kind of static file analysis and sandbox filters, and, you know, it gets more sophisticated as you get into it. And we stopped seeing that much ransomware. We still see a bit, but we started seeing ransomware coming away from the opportunistic type attacks. In other words, coming in from spam, and started seeing it become a lot more targeted, because they realized that for ransomware to be successful, we actually needed to get past people who had sort of pretty good but not great email hygiene solutions. And so ransomware, which was getting blocked by the pretty good but not great email hygiene solutions, started getting much more targeted, and then it started slipping through, and was then only getting blocked by. And what was interesting, and this is a comment I make generally, is saying there's a lot of vendors out there who've got what they call this massive global network of sensors. But if you think about it in as a sort of a weather analogy, that's a lot like having a whole bunch of thermometers out there. And yes, you can tell the temperature, but you can tell nothing about humidity, wind speed, rainfall, all of those sorts of things. So if you've got the wrong kind of sensors, it doesn't matter how many of them you've got. And we started seeing a number of vendors missing this completely because the ransomware got more sophisticated. In fact, the ransomware stayed the same. The actual malware stayed the same, but the delivery mechanism got more sophisticated and started slipping past these sensor networks.
Interesting. Interesting what you say about crypto mining scams. And they were peaking, what you said, about two and a half years ago.
It started out as a, you know, people saw it more of as a nuisance initially, and didn't really tend to see it as that big a problem. And it grew quite quickly. Now, in a sense, it is still just a nuisance. All it's really doing is stealing CPU cycles and electricity, mining cryptocurrency, typically Monero for some reason. But I think that was just, you know, you often have these sort of patterns that evolve. They don't really mean too much. But the whole trick behind the crypto mining thing was that they kind of stayed below the radar, didn't annoy too many people, focused more on the consumer space than the business space. In fact, you still see a lot of crypto mining in that area. But if you think about it, if someone's got a foothold on your machine, that's not a good thing at all, because they can actually use that as a kind of beachhead to get other malware into, and we started seeing that over time. In fact, that's been a trend in malware. Is malware kind of started out in almost sort of verticals. You got things like banking trojans, which are focused specifically on stealing banking credentials, and then other types of malware, which was focused specifically on things like stealing credentials or key logging or whatever the case may be. But over time, these things started to build into these kind of platform type malwares. And that's what, so the kind of principle behind it is what you really don't want any form of malware on your machine at all, even if it is doing something sort of fairly mild in inverted commas, like crypto mining.
Yeah. How are companies like Mimecast fighting the scourge of malware that's out there? I mean, it must be very difficult to keep up with the inventiveness of some of these criminals. Are you able to apply artificial intelligence, machine learning in the fight?
Yeah, we absolutely are. So we use a number of different layers. The first thing we do is we just look for signatures. We look for signatures in the email itself of things that we've seen before. And we tend to then reject a huge amount. We've got grids globally. That's sort of a Mimecast data center in various countries, as I mentioned. And if something gets picked up, for example, in Australia, we then immediately send that information across to every single grid in real time, which means if a threat actor has a campaign in Australia and then try that same campaign here in South Africa, we then block it automatically. So that's a kind of at the most simplistic level, is we just look for the kind of the signature or the fingerprint, whatever you want to call it, of malware.
Yeah.
That's stuff that we know about. We use a combination of third-party tools as well as our own. So we then use, as I mentioned, three different antivirus engines. The reason we use three different antivirus engines is, and this is actually not a well-known point, but at any given time, no antivirus engine knows about all the malware in the world. Mm-hmm. So most of them will know about sort of 98% of it, but there's always that 2% difference. And luckily, if you get three or more antivirus engines, you then cover that 100% of all the malware in the world. So most people think they're covered if they've got an antivirus engine. Well, they are to about 98%. I mean, that's a little bit of a moving target, but it averages out at about 98%.
So,
there's going to be a long answer to a short question. So the next level, this is where we start to use things like heuristics. and machine learning to pick up something that sort of walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, swims like a duck is probably a duck. Mm-hmm. We pick up a lot of malware like that. And then we've got something called static file analysis. So you see a lot of malware come in the form of not actually being a, you know, sort of an executable file, but something that's actually built into traditional documents like Excel spreadsheets or PowerPoint files or Word documents. And they start doing some, you know, sort of dodgy things. So we've got a tool that actually then picks up whether or not a typical office type, office productivity type document has got any form of malicious code in it. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we've got what's called a sandbox. And the sandbox, hopefully, because sandboxes actually take quite a while, because essentially, as I say, they're emulating what the, you know, the environment that the malware wants to land up in. But they've got to emulate it in such a way that the malware doesn't know that it's in a sandbox. If you remember all the way back to the WannaCry virus, in fact, I forget if it was WannaCry or NotPetya, which is actually not that good of me not to remember the difference, but there was a kill switch supposedly built into the virus, and someone
I remember that, the yes. kill switch. Yeah, it was NotPetya.
The kill switch was actually not a kill switch. Well, it had the effect of being a kill switch, but the kill switch was actually a sandbox identification technique. It's something that malware does, is it tries to figure out if it's sitting inside a sandbox. So initially, sandboxes were fairly simple. They were just virtual machines. A piece of malware would come in, and it would get caught because you'd sit there and you'd detonate. It would try and do something, go, caught the malware. And the malware authors got clever, and it became a bit of an arms race. And they said, well, I'm going to look for things like keyboard movement keystrokes and mouse movement and this sort of thing, you know, attached printers, just see if it's a real environment. And then what malware started doing is actually just going into a kind of hold cycle because they knew it can't sit in a sandbox forever. You know, you only have a certain amount of time, maybe half an hour before you've actually got to release the file. Mm-hmm. And so it went on, you know, you had this arms race. And what this kill switch effectively did is the malware reached out to a website and a domain that had not been registered. And that particular security researcher, who actually had a bit of a sort of checkered, a time thereafter, but at the time was sort of something of a hero, actually registered that domain. And the malware then, NotPetya then assumed that it was actually sitting inside a sandbox and did nothing. And that was why had the effect of being a kill switch. So the point being, you have all these sort of obfuscation techniques that malware tries to do to try and kind of hide itself from all of these security layers that I've just described. It gets quite complex. I think the last critical part that Mimecast does in that whole space is we actually do a lot of threat sharing. Mm-hmm. So what we do with our clients is we try to leverage the existing investment that they've got in the existing security estate. So a typical client will have some form of endpoint protection. A typical client will have a firewall. A typical client might have some sort of intrusion prevention system, et cetera. And all of these know a little bit about the sort of cybersecurity space, but only in their kind of narrow swim lane. And what we do is we start sharing threat intelligence with them. So they may know about a piece of malware that we haven't yet detected and vice versa. And we do what's called bilateral threat sharing. Mm-hmm. And that's growing quite rapidly now. And it's actually working, you know, where it's been implemented correctly is actually an incredibly sort of useful way of, first of all, leveraging what you've got and kind of leveraging the best of breed products as opposed to buying from a single vendor who's going to be good at one thing but can't be good at everything, and sort of getting that sort of best of everything. The analogy I always use there is the kind of pentathlon athlete versus the individual sprinter, high jumper, you know, etc. You know, there's always the guys who focus in one area are always better, but that they're not going to be good globally. But to try and get them all to work together well is difficult.
Yeah.
So organizations that have done that well are sort of reaping the benefit.
Ryan, before I let you go, and I know this might be a bit of a broad question, but you interface a lot, I'm sure, with corporate organizations in South Africa to discuss security issues. What, in your view, are companies doing right and wrong in a sort of broad strokes, if you could maybe paint a broad strokes picture of what South African corporates are doing, generally doing right, and what they're generally doing wrong, and what advice you'd give to them broadly in the current situation that we found ourselves in?
Sure. Okay. So multi-part question there. I think there's sort of islands of excellence, if I can call it that. And without calling out specific brands, I think in the banking sector, for example, there's a lot of sharing of threat information. It could always be better, but mm-hmm. but it's really good that they kind of, even though they compete with each other, you know, out on the street, they help each other out when it comes to being attacked by threat actors. So I think those kinds of, you see that in other parts of the financial services space as well. So you see it in, you know, sort of the long and short term insurance companies and things like that. We're not seeing a lot of that elsewhere. We do have our certs and various other things, and companies are trying to kind of get involved in that space. But I'd say that's where things are being done well. Where I think things are being done badly, and again, not calling out any specific organization, because, you know, I think every situation is different, is there's not a lot of sharing of information when something goes wrong. So some of those high profile cases that you've mentioned previously, and a number of others, you can just scour the headlines of data breaches and things. We very rarely get under the hood of those, even in kind of, you know, closed situations, you know, that are not public. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to a number of chief information security officers as to why that's the case. And they would ideally like to have a situation where they could grill the CISO from, say, a financial services organization that got breached to say, how did this happen? What did you guys do? What worked well? What didn't? Which product sets worked for you? Which didn't? Where was the actual cause of the attack ultimately? And, you know, some of that information is there, but most of it is done informally. There's very little that's done formally, which means a little bit like, if you want to take it back to an analogy of the coronavirus, it's a little bit like China initially trying to downplay the crisis and hoarding information and not being kind of as open as they could have been. And, you know, obviously over time that changed and they were a lot more open and they released a lot more information, which other countries then used. Companies don't do something similar when it comes to attacks. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot, you know, there's obviously legal implications. You know, people don't want the legal liability around that. Things are going to get a lot tougher when the POPI Act finally sort of kicks into force, because there's obviously fines associated with data breaches and things. So I think in a way that's, we're going to be forced to declare breaches, but I think the critical information around the cause of the breach, and what other companies could do differently next time around is not shared. And threat actors absolutely love that because they can then reuse the same technique over and over again at different companies. And if only we could be a lot more open in a safe environment that had no kind of legal liability associated, we could get a lot better at sharing threats.
I was going to ask why companies don't share that information. It's mainly a legal liability, you think? I suppose it could also just be embarrassment.
I think I've heard stories, and again, won't name any names, but I've heard stories where sort of meetings were set up to share information about a breach to literally the day before it happened being called off because the legal department of the company in question was just very unhappy with that information coming out. So I think, unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, the lawyers, just had too much of a kind of just way too risk averse, let's say.
Yeah.
So that is a challenge. And it's certainly an area for improvement. If we could find a way to, you know, anonymize that information in some way, or at the very least get people to sign non-disclosures, it would certainly help organizations more broadly.
Yeah.
I think if companies could get better threat sharing, so using, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Mimecast, but using the same process, we're seeing a lot more of that start to happen. But that's definitely, you know, a very, very small percentage of companies is actually share the threats that they see. So even threats that they've blocked, or their tool sets are blocked, they typically don't share those more broadly and say, hey, you know, we're a retail company, for example, and these are the kind of attacks we're seeing. We're getting hits here, there, and everywhere, and here's a whole lot of information. We'll share it more broadly amongst retailers, for example. The banks do that quite well, mm-hmm. But other sort of industry verticals don't do that well at all.
Brian, this has been a fascinating discussion. I think we could probably carry on for the rest of the afternoon, but I think let's leave it there. Brian Pinnock is Director of Sales Engineering at Mimecast Middle East and Africa. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with Tech Central today.
Thank you very much.